Father, we are burdened here. I pray that Robert would fold. Not just know about you, not just have religion, but a real, living, active, life-shaping, life-giving relationship. According to your word, the power of your spirit, the real thing. Pray that even this horrible thing like a stroke would have the effect of drawing him to you. Lord, our prayer for him, of course, is that he would recover fully, would have wisdom that they need to do the things they need to do, or if you choose not to heal by means of doctors, Lord, we're always up for miracles. at least I am. That's what we're praying for, Lord. But the most important thing in Robert's life is not even physical healing. It's him to come to know you, fullness. So I pray just at work in his life. Father, thank you so much for allowing us to get together tonight, people that have joined us. And I pray that you would bless the time that we have tonight. Teach us, show us truth, and help us. I pray in Jesus' strong name. All right, y'all. So we tonight are in the second half of Revelation chapter 3. It continues to get just weirder and weirder and stranger and stranger and stranger. And we talked a lot last week about the beasts of the land. And if you remember, I tried to identify the beasts from the land not as some antichrist figure that's going to come in our future, but rather a figure from the past, and identified that beast as being the emperor of Rome. And at the moment that John was writing, that was, you guys remember, who was that emperor who was on the throne when John was writing?
Nero.
At least that's the way I see it. You know, I could be wrong. The reality is that all of this is pretty speculative. We have no way of knowing sure what's the best way to interpret this. But I think that the way I'm laying in front of you, obviously, I think is the best way, is the right way. So I think it's primarily referring to the Roman emperor, not so much as any one emperor, but just the reality, the office of the Roman. But I think clearly, especially at the very end of this chapter, points you in the direction of the emperor who was on the throne of Rome at the time that John wrote this while he was in exile on Patmos, which, if you remember, I believe was in the mid-60s A.D., not in the 90s A.D., a 30-year gap. We've talked repeatedly about the difference between the date of Revelations that a lot of modern interpreters take, which is in the 90s A.D., and the date which many of the original and oldest interpreters of the Book of Romans took, which is in the 70s, or I should say in the 60s A.D., leading up to the events of 78. But there are some pretty heavyweight scholars, even to this very day, who say that they also believe that John was writing in the mid-60s A.D., and I certainly agree with that bunch. So I think the beast from the sea is the Roman emperor. And specifically in John's mind, in John's day, he's thinking Nero. If you remember, we also talked about how it also refers to the emperor who would be on the throne in 70 A.D. When finally his son Titus, as the general of the Roman army there in Jerusalem, would actually break through the walls of Jerusalem and level the place. Specifically, leave not one stone of temple. I think it also talks about how the empire went through about a year, maybe a year and a half, of real serious turmoil between the death of Nero and the ascendancy of Vespasian, when there were three different emperors in between those two who were only ruling for like a matter of months before someone assassinated. And there was just problems all over the place. So if you remember what I said from last week, I thought that the deadly wound that the one head of the beast had was this period of time when it looked like the the empire was about to die because the emperors were all dying and everything seemed to be falling apart. And yet Vespasian in some ways was considered to be like the resurrection of the Roman Empire. But that's the first half of the book of Revelation 13. And now we're jumping into the second half, beginning in verse 11 of Revelation 13. So let me read. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. Remember, in this place, as in most places in the book of Revelation, I take the word, the Greek word geis, to be best translated with the word land. And I would put a capital L on that because I'm just talking about the land of Israel or the land of Judea or the land of Palestine. You can just choose whatever name you want to give to that land, what we call the Holy Land. I think it's speaking specifically about that land, okay? That's a perfectly acceptable, good translation of the Greek word geis. If when you read the word earth, you see in your mind a globe, that's not a good translation because probably John didn't have that in his mind. And probably nobody that he was writing to would have had that in their mind as what is meant by the word geis. I'm hearing something. What am I hearing? Was that a question? What was that? Hey, Vicky Gutierrez.
Good
to have you with us. Good to have you with us. Okay, well, I thought I heard something. I wasn't sure if that was a question. By the way, if you do have a question, just ask it, you know, and I like it a whole lot better when you interrupt me with questions, or if I say something that seems wacky to you, then, you know, say, hey, wait a minute, preacher man. You know, it's okay. I love to have this kind of conversation. I like it when it even devolves into a debate. That's a big fun time for me. So please jump in there if you do have a question. So another beast rising out of the land of Israel, land of Palestine. It had two horns like a lamb. So you shouldn't see horns like on a ram, you know, mountain goats that we know in America, or a ram like a sheep that you would see, big curling, pointy horns. You shouldn't see like the 10 horns growing out of the spine of the beast, these sharp, pointed, horrible, terrible-looking horns. You should see the kind of horns that you might see on the head of a lamb, two little nubs growing up. In other words, we'll talk about what that might symbolize, okay? We want to get this in our minds. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth, are out of the land. It had two horns like a lamb. It spoke like a dragon. It's the most remarkable picture. We'll talk about that a lot. It had two horns like a lamb. It spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence and makes the land and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose mortal wound was healed. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. And by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on the land, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the slain. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. The one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast. For it is the number of a man. His number is 666. All right. That's really, really crazy. All right. So I'm gonna try and split up this passage two telling sections that sort of tell us what we need to know about this land beast. And so we'll talk about him together, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So before we do that, I wonder if any of you can tell me what sorts of things you have heard about this land beast. Anybody? I can't believe that you all haven't heard anything about it, because I know I heard an awful lot about it when I was young. By the way, over on Facebook, we have Neil Wolf with us, and Dolly Willinger says, hello, church. And that's all I see that's there on Facebook. Hello to you guys. I'm glad you're with us. Neil, maybe you can drop me a note and let me know if your mom got the note that I left her on this morning's Facebook video. Because she asked a question or made a point, and I tried to explain something to her about the technical details of why we could or couldn't put certain things across on Facebook. And I wasn't sure if she got that message or not. I tried to call later on in the day. Maybe you can drop me a note and let me know. Appreciate it. Anyway, let me come back to everybody here. I'm sorry I was taking just a moment to speak to Neil because I was concerned about, well, not real concerned about. Linda just had a question about why she couldn't hear a song. And I tried to explain some of the technical stuff of why people on Facebook couldn't hear that, but people on Uber Conference could. And, of course, people in the sanctuary. Anyway, let's get back to this here. All right. The Land Beast. I want to say something about him. The Land Beast is clearly connected to this. It's very, very obvious. Just as you read from chapter 12 into chapter 13, that the dragon and the land beasts and the sea beasts are all connected to each other in a key way. They're parallel in the story. You find out in chapter 16 and in chapter 19 that the three of them appear together repeatedly. Okay, this is only the beginning of these three showing up together. Anyway, we are only just about to get started. But here, clearly, you don't even have to go very far to figure out that there's a connection or there's a parallelism. So let me read verse 11 again. Then I saw another beast rising out of the land. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. Merciful heavens. All right, so I just want to look at four different elements of that one sentence over the next couple of minutes, and then we'll look at the rest of the passage as God allows us to. The four different elements of that sentence are the beast, the land, the lamb, and the dragon. And so let's talk about those one by one. First of all, the beast, okay? This is the same word for this beast from the land as used for the beast from the sea. And if you remember, the dragon in the sky was actually referred to earlier in Revelation as the beast from the bottomless pit. And I said the dragon in the sky was the same as the beast from the bottomless pit, because both the dragon in the sky and the beast from the bottomless pit are references to Satan. Now, these are all symbols that appear in a vision, okay? They are not things that literally did happen or will happen in the physical world. We're told from the very beginning of the book of Revelation that it's symbolic, that it's a prophecy, and it's full of signs and symbols. I mean, it comes right out and tells us that. I don't know why everybody who reads this, not everybody, but so many people who read it think, well, this has to be literal. Everything has to be literal. Not if it tells you from the get-go that it's full of symbols. You know, I'm not saying that nothing else in the Bible is full of symbols. Actually, the Bible's full of all kinds of symbols. There's literal symbolic language that a literary professor or something would call a symbol. There are other things that more you would call similes or metaphors. You know, there's all kinds of figures of speech that show up all throughout the Bible, just like there is in every other kind of writing or speech, for that matter, that human beings have ever been involved in. But here, these two beasts and the dragon, or if you realize the dragon is himself a beast, these three beasts, they're symbols of something. The dragon is a symbol of the devil, Satan. Sea beast is a symbol of the Roman emperor, most especially Nero. Well, what about this land beast? I think it'll help you and me if we realize that the sea beast was a reference to not just one person, but rather an office that several different people filled at the time. Does that make sense? Let me say it again. It might help us to remember that the sea beast was not just one person, but rather an office. And that office was filled by different people at different times. Just like if you say the president of the United States, well, last year or last month, that was Donald Trump. Well, this month, it's Joe Biden. Two different guys, one office. Does that make sense? So the sea beast, primarily somebody who's an office. Okay. But then specifically, John's going to get very, very, very narrow in his focus. And by the time that we're done with chapter 13, he's going to clearly identify this beast as Nero. But I think the beast, we should see Nero, we should see Vespasian, we should see the three emperors who were on the throne. They weren't literally on the throne, all of them. Many of them, I think, never even quite got to Rome before they got killed. Because they got declared Roman, declared the emperor by their own particular army section, you know, their legion, said, our leader is now the emperor of Rome. We're going to go back to Rome and take over everything. And at times at each time that got some attention from some people, but didn't last very long before he was literally killed and somebody else now was declaring himself to be the emperor. And like I said, all of that happened. Those three guys came and went within the space of about a year to a year and a half. That was between Nero and Vespasian. Actually, if you can remember, do you remember how Nero knew Vespasian from anything that I've said? Okay, let me remind you guys if I need to, okay? Vespasian was a Roman general who had been very successful in leading various military campaigns in different places around the empire. He really didn't want anything to do with political power. He seemed to think that Nero was kind of a buffoon, although he wouldn't say that. He was like a lot of soldiers. He was just kind of a very basic, matter-of-fact kind of guy, you know. And the reason why he ended up being everyone's favorite for being the emperor was because he was in the middle of carrying out a successful campaign against the Jews in Judea. Let me ask you this question. Are you aware of any successful generals who went on to become president of the United States?
Eisenhower.
There's one.
Grant.
Anybody else?
Grant.
U.S. Grant. There you go. Who else? He's on a $20 bill. Andrew Jackson is on. Some of you guys are like digging through your wallets going, well, who's on the $20 bill? Andrew Jackson is on the $20 bill, and he was elected president because he was a very successful general. George Washington, the father of our country, the first president,
yeah.
Right?
How could we miss that?
Okay. I'm sorry?
How could we miss that?
Sometimes the most obvious thing is not quite so obvious, yeah, after all. Well, just like we do like the Romans did, okay? If somebody was a successful general in warfare, it oftentimes led to political power. And that happened before Rome even became an empire, while it was still a republic. In fact, there's a long, horrible story about how the end of the republic came about because of successful generals who, over the course of about 200 years, successful generals got closer and closer to becoming the emperor, you know. The one most successful general who got very, very close to becoming emperor and was assassinated before he could become emperor was the uncle of the first emperor. The first emperor was Augustus Caesar, and his uncle was Julius Caesar, okay? All that's interesting history. Interesting to me anyway. The way people thought and did was they took successful generals and turned them into emperors. So the beast from the sea was clearly the Roman emperor, okay? And all kinds of people were trying to be the emperor, okay? And after Nero either was assassinated or killed himself, it's not sure what it was, not clear. There was you know, this great confusion about who was going to be emperor next. And the one guy who became emperor, Vespasian, really didn't want to be emperor. You know, all he really wanted was to finish his last military campaign, conquer, you know, this crazy city, Jerusalem, get the troublemaking people, the Jews, to be done making trouble. And then he wanted to just retire. So it's what everyone says about him, you know. But he instead became emperor because everybody looked at him and said, here's a guy we can trust. And, you know, as it turned out, he was a pretty effective emperor as far as emperors go. But what he wasn't at all was he wasn't a man who knew God or cared about God. In fact, he was a Roman thoroughly. So this beast from the sea is like the beast from the land in that this is a definite office fulfilled by definite people at definite points in time. Beast from the land. So let's make sure that we know what we're talking about with the land then, okay? You see it's parallel in the writing or the thinking of John or of God as he is putting together this vision for John to have. If you remember when John was looking into the sky and seeing a beast in the sky or a dragon in the sky, and he saw this woman and the woman's offspring and all the things that we saw in chapter 12. It ended up with John on the seashore looking at the sea. So the picture is John is on the shore of the sea in Palestine looking at the sea. What sea was he looking at if he was on the shore of the sea in Palestine? Say, wait a minute, I don't know. I have to get out my map. actually, he would be on the shore of the Mediterranean Sea. He would be looking to the west, be looking in the direction of Rome, okay? And so it's very clear that the sea is the Mediterranean Sea and the sea beast is Rome. Well, where's the shore then? The shore is the shore of the land that he's talking about, the land that he focused on in chapter 12, the land that he's been focused on again and again throughout this book, okay, keeps showing up. It just means the land of Palestine or the land that you might call the land of Judea. You might call it the promised land or the holy land, but that land, that's where the beast, this second beast comes from. So we thought for a moment about the beast and the land. Let's think for a second about the lamb. It says that this beast had two horns like a lamb. And I've already mentioned to you that as we're thinking, we're getting a picture of a lamb. It's a little boy sheep. It probably doesn't have full-grown horns yet because it's not even grown up yet. It's got probably little nubs that are almost like cute or something, you know. It's like the little picture of a baby lion trying to roar, you know. It's cute. Well, that's the picture we should see in our mind, okay? He's seeing something that's got two horns like a lamb, but he's already described it not as a lamb, but as a beast. He's just saying it has horns. Like a lamb's horn. And so if you remember, we've talked a couple times about what horns normally symbolize in the Bible. Remember what we've said? A horn is usually a symbol of
power and authority.
Power and authority. It's exactly right. Power, influence. So this is a symbol of power, but pretty minuscule power in comparison with the first, you know. In fact, the influence that this beast wields would seem to be not based on like force or violence or the kinds of things that the first beast relied on for its power. He doesn't have that kind of power. His power is limited. So what conclusions can we come to? There is another lamb who's mentioned in the book of Revelation. Who's that other lamb in Revelation?
The lamb that was slain.
Jesus.
The lamb that was slain. And who's that? That's a definite
not
person. Right? That's the Lord Jesus, right? But when he appears as a lamb slain. In fact, the whole idea of a lamb in the book of Revelation almost has the idea of slaughter built into the idea. So what do I know that is in some way parallel or connected to the first Roman emperor that is in some ways like Jesus or connected to Jesus, but is different Jesus, that is connected to the slaughter of lambs and animals? Is there anything that we can think of that would be both? I'm sorry?
A priest,
specifically the priesthood in Jerusalem. I believe that this symbol is a symbol of the high priestly class in Jerusalem, specifically, if it ever gets boiled down to one person, sometimes it does, the high priest. As a matter of fact, if you remember back in your description of sort of how things worked in Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Acts, then you remember that the most influential person in Jerusalem was the high priest. Okay. I mean, there was the family of the Herods, you know, based people who were descended from Herod the Great. But they had like a presence in Jerusalem. They had a palace in Jerusalem, but they weren't really the ones who were in charge in Jerusalem. The person who was in charge in Jerusalem was a high priest, and the office or the position or the institution that sort of dominated everything about Jerusalem was the temple, the priesthood of the temple. In fact, there was a name for the high priest, for the priestly caste, the priestly family, the priestly aristocracy in Jerusalem. That party or that group of people that they showed up repeatedly during the life of Jesus. You remember who they were? Not really sure, huh?
Which tribe was it?
Well, it wasn't one of the 12 tribes. It was a class of people. If you remember who the Sadducees and the Pharisees were, the Sanhedrin was the ruling council that was made up of Sadducees and Pharisees, basically. Okay? And if you remember, the Sadducees were the oldest class. They were the high priestly family. Their power base was in the temple. They were very proud of the idea that they were all descended from Aaron, specific, and Levi in general. They were a tribe because they were all from the tribe of Levi. The Sadducees. That's who is the land beast. Now, there was another group, the Pharisees, and Jesus ran into trouble with them a lot, too. Their power base was not in the temple. It was in the synagogues, and they weren't priests. They were rabbis. So both of those groups gave Jesus all kinds of trouble when he was alive, and both of those groups gave Christians all kinds of trouble after Jesus had died and risen from the dead and ascended back to heaven. But I really believe that this land beast is the Sadducee, and specifically the high priest. And why do I think that? First of all, the way this beast is described really fits in lots of ways with the way that the high priestly class, that is the Sadducees, or the high priest himself, Annas, Caiaphas, Alexander, there are many who are named. We know them from Josephus's works, and we know them from the book of Acts, and even some Roman histories mention one or two of the high priests, okay? Mostly, though, from Acts and Josephus are how we know who the high priests were and what they did. And if you look at the way that that priestly class, that priestly aristocracy of Jerusalem, how did they relate to the Romans? It becomes pretty clear that if in fact the sea beast is the Roman emperor, then it makes an awful lot of sense, especially in light of what we're going to learn in chapter 16 and chapter 19. It makes a whole lot of sense to think of this sea beast as the priestly aristocracy, specifically the high priest in Jerusalem. Do you guys have any questions or any thoughts about that? I'm hearing nothing. So at least if the answer is no, say no, so I'll know you're listening.
It's very confusing.
Okay. Fair enough. So that's such a helpful thing. Thank you so much. Okay. So let me go back and say it again, and we'll be try to be clear about who is what. And then I'll ask you to try to explain what's most confusing. Okay. The sea beast is the Roman emperor, specifically Nero, at the time that Revelation was written. Although Revelation was written about events that were going to happen in the next couple of years after it was written, and Nero was no longer going to be the emperor. Other guys would, you know. But the whole point is that the sea beast, the Rome under the emperors, okay? The land beast is the priesthood in Jerusalem. Now, you tell me why is that confusing? Because I know why it was confusing to me the first time I heard the idea. But why don't you share with me what's confusing about it to you, and then we'll try and address that.
Well, it was confusing to me because you were saying, talking about the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Then you mm-hmm. said the land beast was the Sadducees.
Yep.
So is it just the Sadducees or the Pharisees and the Sadducees?
I think it's the Sadducees. And I think that for a couple reasons, okay? The Pharisees were much more likely to be opposed to Rome, and they were more likely to line up with the zealots and others who, there were several different parties or groups at work in Judea of the time, okay? In lots of ways, the oldest, the richest, the most influential, and the most conservative of the groups was the Sadducees. And I don't mean conservative the way we think. I mean conservative the way they think of conservative, okay? Because they could trace the beginnings of their movement all the way back to Levi, like one of the 12 sons of Jacob, okay? And they could specifically trace their movement back to one of the descendants of Levi, who became the first high priest. That's Aaron. That's why it's called the Aaronic priesthood. If you remember, Aaron was the first high priest, you know, Aaron as in the brother of Moses, you know. So they traced their priesthood back all the way back through history. And they were right to do that because they had been in that position all that time, except during the 70 years of the exile when there was no temple. After Nebuchadnezzar had destroyed the temple, you remember us talking about how the Babylonians under Emperor Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple in 586 BC, and for a number of years there was no temple, there was no sacrifices, and so there was no priesthood, no active priesthood. But there was still a bunch of guys who could trace their ancestry back. You know, long before there was Ancestry.com, there was the Bible. and the Bible's full of long lists of ancestors, right? They drive you crazy, right? Don't they? Well, certainly of all the people in the Bible who were really concerned about their ancestry, I mean, everybody was in Israel. They all thought, well, you know, we're from the 12 sons of Jacob, and everybody thought it was a big deal to be able to trace your ancestors, you know, back to wherever. But of all the people in Israel that really cared the most about being able to trace that ancestry, it would really have to come down to maybe the descendants of David cared more than the people, the descendants of Levi. Maybe they did, but maybe not. I mean, they cared a lot, because if you're a descendant of David, then hey, he was the king, and the line of the kings comes from David, so I'm royalty, right? Well, if right. you're a descendant of Levi or a descendant of Aaron, then you're not quite the same kind of royalty. You're more like a religious or spiritual royalty, you know? You're the line of the priests, right? And so, you know, they cared about that. And you would hope that all of the priests, and especially the high priest, would be godly men who did their duties before the Lord out of pure heart of genuine faith. You would hope that. But do you think that's the way it usually works?
No.
I mean, you can look at preachers today, and we don't have a priesthood the way they did. But can preachers be corrupt people?
Yes.
Who worship power and money? Sure they can. Well, and that's just in Baptist circles where, you know, every church is independent, you know, from every other church. Well, how about in a Catholic setting where they literally can trace, I was ordained by somebody who 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 was ordained by somebody. They should be able to trace their ordination record all the way to one of the apostles. Roman Catholics should be able to do that. Episcopalians should be able to do that. Eastern Orthodox should be able to do that, okay? Because they believe that trail of ordinations is kind of a source of their legitimacy as the priests of God, all right? So that's just Christian, all right? But let's go back in time even further, right? And go back to the time of Jesus, the time of the book of Revelation. These priests can trace their history all the way back to Abraham, all right? Many of them can. And they're very proud of that. And they have a level of influence and wealth and power, especially in Jerusalem, that is based on that genealogy, okay? Does that make sense? Yeah. So the question is, well, but how would they be connected to the first? Well, we'll get into that in a second, okay? If you want to know how the Jewish leadership, especially in the temple, would be connected to the Roman Empire. Now, for some of you, perhaps that's already clear because you can think about things from your Bible that would let you know that. But I'm going to show you some specific things in a moment here if we have time, although we've only got about 9 minutes left, but we'll do our best, okay? All of that came from those words, the lamb, okay? Who is this beast who has these two little horns like a lamb? Let's go back and read again, because we never really got out of verse 11, okay? So let's go back and read verse 11 again. Then I saw another beast rising out of the land. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. So we ought to think about the dragon he talked about, okay? What do you think it means to say that it spoke like a dragon?
Spoke with authority.
Okay. Thank you. Dragons tended to be kind of scary and intimidating when they had something to say. In culture after culture around the world, stories of dragons have appeared. The dragon always spoke with authority. The dragon always considered to speak with wisdom or at least wiliness. It could be quite deceptive. But then again, it could be quite beautiful in what it said. It could be very convincing in what it said. And it's not just the story in the Bible of the dragon at the beginning, the serpent, the dragon of old, you know, as he's described in chapter 12. The serpent of old is that ancient serpent is also referred to as a dragon. If you remember what I've said, I think the serpent in the wilderness was not a snake. I think he was a dragon. And we can go back and have that discussion if you want to, but I don't want to right now. But to say that he spoke like a dragon, it means specifically in this context, he just got finished talking in chapter 13 about a dragon. It was like the first beast was the dragon himself. The second beast was the beast from the sea. The third beast is the beast from the land, and all three are tied together so that the Roman Empire and the Roman Emperor are fueled and fired by the devil himself. And I'm saying I think that the priesthood in Jerusalem is being manipulated and doing the work of the devil himself. So who is this land beast? Well, whoever he is, he speaks as convincingly as the old dragon himself. Is it right for me to connect the priesthood in Jerusalem to the devil? to the dragon? Well, since the time of Jesus or before, they've been busily talking people out of coming to Christ, which means they've been busily talking people into going to hell. If you remember, it wasn't just the Pharisees that hated him. The Sadducees hated him desperately. If you remember, in a lot of ways, Jesus was kind of on the Pharisee team. In a lot of ways, he agreed with the Pharisees about a lot of things. But the Sadducees, they didn't like Jesus at all. And they did everything in their power to try to talk people out of following Jesus. And the truth is that when, excuse me while I stand up for a second, I've got to stretch. My body hurts. I'm getting old here. If you think about it, were the Pharisees or the Sadducees more influential in getting Jesus crucified? Do you remember this? You would think it's the Pharisees because we always kind of like to use that word as like the bad guys. And in some ways, Jesus had some serious problems with the Pharisees. He really did. But remember, he was kind of on their team, on their side. He believed most of the same things they did. If you look back at just the stories of how Jesus himself was crucified, the high priests, they were the ones who were most influential in talking the Romans to crucifying. Does that sound right? Maybe you've never noticed this. But if you were to go back and just like sort of review the crucifixion stories, and more to the point, the stories of the betrayal of Jesus and the trials of Jesus, okay, as he tried before the high priest and tried before Herod and tried before Pilate, you won't find a lot of talk about the Pharisees. They weren't really influential or significant in. It was the priests. They hated him. And they were the ones who had the power to do something about him. Now, the Pharisees were more influential than people. Pharisees were kind of blue-collar guys like us. They would fit right in Dundalk, you know. That just, you know, people who work with their hands. They're the people who would relate to the Pharisees. But the Sadducees, they would be more at home in Washington, D.C. You know what I'm saying? Well, I'm just saying, in the halls of power and wealth, that's where they would want to be.
So the high priest comes out of the Sadducees line?
Yeah, always.
Okay.
Sadducees are the same thing as, or almost the same thing, as the high priestly line, okay? The line of Aaron. So if you go back and read, say, in Exodus and then in Joshua, Aaron dies, and his son, was it Phinehas, takes over. And then there's just a line of descendants of Aaron who become high priests or various kinds of priests. Now, I make it sound like all of them were bad, but not all of them were bad. By the time of Jesus, there were lots of priests from the line of Aaron, and some of them were really good. In fact, one of them was a really godly man. And the book of Luke starts off with a story about him. Do you remember that? John the Baptist's father, Zechariah. Zechariah? Is his name Zechariah or Ananias? Not Ananias. I can never get that straight.
It was Zechariah.
Sorry? Zechariah? Yeah.
Zechariah.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't. It's not coming to my head for sure. Definitely. So he was a devout, godly man looking for the Messiah to come, believed the Bible that he had, and when it was his turn to go into the temple and do his work as one of the sons of Aaron, you know, that was like the high point of his life. And lo and behold, an angel shows up to him and tells him that his wife's going to have a baby. So what a great thing, and what an amazing man. So, you know, I don't want you to think that all of the Sadducees were like evil people, because this is not the case. But I do want you to especially to know that, especially when you read, say, in Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Acts, or if you read in the one history that we have of the time outside of the Bible, which is the works of Josephus. I mean, when I say the one history, I mean the one extensive history, okay? The high priests do not show up as really good people. They show up as corrupt, powerful people who are in bed with Rome because Rome is keeping them in power and they are trying to help the people to to live with the power of Rome. So let me give you an example, okay? If you go to John chapter 11, and we're already after 7 o'clock, so but let me give you an example, okay, of this connection between the power of the Aaronic priesthood and the power of the Roman emperor, okay? John chapter 11, beginning in verse 45. One of you guys read that for me. Hey, I've been talking too long. My throat actually hurts from talking. John 11, verses 45 through 53. Who can read for us?
How far do you want? I'll read it. How far do you want me to read?
John 11, verses 45 to 53.
Okay, I'll read it.
Thank you.
Then many of the Jews who had come to Mary and had seen the things Jesus did believed in him. But some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things Jesus did. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, "What shall we do? For this man works many signs. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and nation." And one of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all. Nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people and not the whole nation perish." Now this he did not say on his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for that nation only, but also that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad. Then from that day on, they plotted to put him to death.
Thank you for reading that. There is so much to consider and to explain even in that, okay? And probably next week when we come back together, we may look more carefully at that little quote. But I hope you see that here you see the Pharisees and the Sadducees. It doesn't say Sadducees, it says high priests, okay? Right? But remember, high priests and Sadducees are the same people. Okay. It says they gathered the council. That council is the same thing as the Sanhedrin, the high council of the Jews in Jerusalem. It's made up of Sadducees primarily, but also, you know, the most influential Pharisees. So the most influential Sadducees and Pharisees are gathered together, and they're saying, "What are we going to do with this guy?" And some of them say, "Well, we got to do something with him, because otherwise the Romans, he's going to cause a ruckus. The Romans are going to come in here, and they're going to wipe everything out." So they were, it's very clear from just reading our Bible how aware they were of the power of Rome. But we also have stories about how the Roman governor in Jerusalem, well, he wasn't actually based in Jerusalem, based in Caesarea Philippi, but he came to Jerusalem a lot. But the priests definitely knew him. The Sanhedrin knew him. What was his name? The Roman governor? Going back to the time of Jesus. Remember his name?
Pontius Pilate.
Pontius Pilate, that's the guy. Yep. And so obviously the Jewish leaders at that time had a lot to say to him, and it's very clear that they had an influence on him, and he had an influence on them. In fact, although the Roman governor could not come into the temple itself, they actually modified, because he was a Gentile and Gentiles weren't allowed to, they actually modified the building to have a special private door where the priests could come out and talk to the Roman governor when they needed to talk to him and when he needed to talk to them. Now, the Bible doesn't tell you that, but we know that from Josephus, okay? So the point would be that these people who are the religious rulership of Jerusalem, they are clearly working hand in glove with the Romans of that day. So we'll come back and talk more about this next week, okay? We'll finish up in chapter 13 and then go forward. I don't know who was the person who asked or said this made the sentence. It's a little kind of confusing.
That
was Mary? Okay. Thank you for doing that. And whenever that happens, butt in, okay? Because I want to be sure, because if one person is feeling confused, that means there's probably more than one who's feeling confused, right? I definitely don't want us, right? What does all of this have to do with our life? Well, I don't know. Can you see the ways that political leaders like the Romans use and still use religious leaders like the Sadducees? Is that still going on today?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Pope,
And I could say some things about the way that we saw Biden's administration doing that this past week. I just did. But I should also say some things about how I saw Trump's administration do it over and over again as well. Political leaders genuinely, or generally, I should say, find ways to use religious leaders to get what they want. So if what looks like satanic back 2,000 years ago, if it looks that bad, just know that it's still just as bad today. Okay, it's just still as much of the devil. I'm not saying that there are no authentic, genuine, sincere religious leaders, because there's always a Zechariah in there. You know, there's always the Daniel in there. there's these guys who in there who are in positions of high authority in religious or political circles who are genuinely sincere, real believer, and thank God for them. But the truth is, most of them are crooked, as crooked as can be. And you and I should just be wise enough to see through all that. And we should be faithful enough to go ahead and pray for the real believers who are in those high halls of power, that God would help them to stay clean and stay straight, and that God would work in someone's heart. If you remember, for the last 4 years, I've told you that I had my questions about the tale that people were telling about how Trump had become a Christian. I still don't know about that. And I'm still praying that that's so. And, you know, I hear all kinds of things about Biden, and I don't know what to believe, what not to believe. But I know what I should do, and I'm doing it. And I want you to do it as well, okay? Pray for political leaders, and pray for religious leaders who are connecting with them, who are working, that God would do real things. And that God would hinder the devil from doing devious things to this very day.